We're WSA, and we are in the business of designing environments that work. We create workplaces for all sorts of people, and we've always learned a lot by listening. Why? Because architects who listen are people who design, really design, for others, for everyone, and for all of us. This podcast is about what designers hear when they listen carefully to what people want and what people need. Welcome to Workplace Crafted. Hello, and welcome back to Workplace Crafted to continue our journey to explore the future of the workplace in a post-pandemic environment. I'm Tim Hawk, your host, and this podcast is a production of WSA, a multidisciplinary design firm in the Midwest. In today's episode, Ryan Gann, our podcast producer, and I will provide a quick review of findings from season one and also introduce the season two topic. How do we make place on a broader scale? How do we all collectively evolve our city centers, which are largely based on the hub and spoke model? What is it that makes humans feel that they can connect? And how will we convene in the future? And ultimately, how do we provide balance between personal choice, individual liberties, and the parameters and structure that's required to develop equitable environments? These are all very important questions that we explore as we continue how to design the future of the workplace. I hope you enjoy this introduction to season two and follow along throughout the summer and fall. This is season two of our podcast. And during season one, we really explored the history of the workplace, disruption, how the pendulum is swinging back and forth in terms of what the workplace is. We talked a little bit about the design process and the business of design and how design can influence business, all under the theme of how we can evolve the post-pandemic workplace.
I think that's a pretty good summary.
Yeah. What stood out?
I think there's sort of a conversation that's happening within design in a post-pandemic workplace that is elevating the voices of new agents of change. Mm-hmm. Workers have a higher participatory rate in the conversations about how workplaces are designed. There are different areas or different, let's say, roles and responsibilities that are now invited to the table, or are at least now understood to have critical voices and perspectives.
Yes.
Into how workplace design happens and evolves. And I think throughout we talked a little bit more about architect as facilitator, maybe not with those words, but it was us not necessarily just delivering a product. It was about a process that gets us toward some end goal that is design, it is space, but it is functioning as a supportive infrastructure for business goals, for people strategy goals, and for a sense of belonging and sort of culture goals.
Yeah. To me, what stood out in addition to that was the idea of how history is informing us. I particularly remember us discussing Johnson Wax and the evolution of the open office there. And when we were having those discussions, I felt like we may be going back to the future. I know that's a movie. That's a movie, yes. But in relationship to this, in some ways we learn from history and we build on history. So imagine how we are beginning to repurpose. And it seems as if historically people were interested in connecting in certain ways. And as we have evolved, the workplace got siloed or segmented. And then with technology, it got pulled apart. And at the same time, there is this pluralism that was beginning to be layered into our workforce needs. And we've had a real problem with it. So thank goodness for the pandemic, because it's actually spurred us forth and pushed us into a new dynamic where we're beginning to explore these things. And, you know, earlier today I had an interview for a new employee, and the candidate asked me, how do you as a firm live your truth as a workplace specialty firm?
It's a pretty deep question.
Yeah. And I thought, wow, that's pretty astute that you're
basically starting the question of like, how do you live every day what you try to teach to others or lead with others? And my response was, it's a practice. We're learning. And I think that there's no solution that anyone really knows.
I mean, I think that has a lot to do with the pendulum swinging. Mm-hmm. So of learning from history, but also recognizing that some decisions we swing too far one way. And then as we come back, whatever the impetus of that swing back was, it happens in politics, it happens in culture, it happens in everything. So why not happen in design as well?
Right. The other theme that you reinforced, which I think is really important, is the voice of the worker, the employee voice. Like creating a design process that includes their voice changes the design or the architect's viewpoint.
Yeah, I mean, the agency of the worker prior to this, I mean, think about the design of any sort of significant piece of architecture pre-post-war or even pre-21st century. It was all based on an idea from an architect or an architecture team about presenting some sort of gesture, mm-hmm. presenting an idea that was imposed on whatever the function was, whether it was Johnson wax in an open office space, as beautiful as it is. That was an imposition.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they talked to anyone about how workers were actually doing their work necessarily in a meaningful way. There was furniture that was spurred from that was specifically designed to sit in that space. I mean, you can think about it in other ways too, of the way in which we work has so quickly evolved pre-pandemic even, that workplace environments weren't even able to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And those employers weren't able to catch up with workforce wants, needs, and aspirations. So while the pandemic sort of forced everyone to do it, we're now in a place to reevaluate how do we not be in a forced position in some other future scenario. Whatever the cultural impact of the next version of a pandemic is, or if we want to talk about post-war, after a war, there were lots of things that influenced how we worked. There are cultural instances that are going to inform change into the future. How do we, not future-proof, no one has a crystal ball, but how do we begin to set up an infrastructure of conversation?
Yeah.
That allows us to design not flexible spaces. I think we've talked about this in previous episodes too. The definition of flexible isn't necessarily productive or conducive to the types of work that are happening today.
It's informed space, not flexible,
mm-hmm, exactly.
Or it's able to be adapted or agile. Interestingly, at NeoCon last year in June, there was a release of a historic replica of the desk from Johnson Wax by Steelcase.
Steelcase, yeah.
And I probably shouldn't ridicule, but I thought, why now? Why are they pulling this relic? It seemed like it's about regurgitation. And I think in some ways, when we think of Johnson Wax, which I don't mean to focus on it too much, but it is certainly a memorable place. Mm-hmm. And as we transition in our podcast collection here to a broader discussion. So if our first season was about the workplace in a more focused way, let's talk now about how we make place.
Mm-hmm.
How can we talk on different scales about how place is made? And in part of it has to do with creating powerful space that's memorable. And I'm not certain if a relic of that can actually replicate that. I mean, I don't think that you take that desk out of the space and put it in a warehouse in Poughkeepsie that it's going to feel like that place, because it's a collection of the furniture with the place, with the mushroom columns, with the skylights, mm-hmm. with the overall place making that occurred, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could look at a more specific example too. Think about Stonehenge. It is only successful in that specific moment, in that specific space and location on the planet.
Right.
And if you take it out of context, it doesn't work anymore.
Right.
And I think while that's the pendulum on the other side of a dramatic example, that's the same sort of thought that has to be put into furniture selection, put into the existence and coexistence of people, space, furniture, function, work. It's all symbiotic.
Right. So as we begin to look at the sense of place, is it really about prototype? It can't be about prototype.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think that's something that's interesting. That's where a lot of great mid-century design came out of mass production. I think, though, it's about application.
How that is mixed with the context and how the context informs it or whether it feels right.
Yeah, it's sort of like a framework. It's an armature. It's something that you fill in beyond that.
Yeah.
Because I think if you go to something that's too custom, then it starts to lose its relevance in the same way that something too bland or universal begins to lose its relevance.
Right, right.
So it's somewhere, it's like a little teeter-totter. We're like trying to find the soft spot of balance.
Yeah, you want something that's between the ideal and pure and the totally handcrafted to the specific moment that's able to make people feel like they're a part of a collective. And we talked about this a little earlier offline, but it seems like as we search in the post-pandemic for what the workplace will become, and we begin to think about the idea of place making, we're really talking about how we bring people together and how we convene. So instead of looking at how we create a method of coming to a place for a particular purpose, like the workplace, like let's look at Chicago, for example, the history of Chicago. It was developed, I mean, the downtown is called the Loop because there were trains that commuted to the center of the city and looped around and went back, right? Mm-hmm. So that center city is the hub. And everything in the city is set up. Roadways, transportation infrastructure. I mean, even there's the Burnham overlay with the axial relationship of like Clark Street and such coming to the center.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that stuff is concentrated on the center. But what the center is no longer what it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's part of the, it's not just about convening, it's about the transition from point A to point B and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a city like Chicago, particularly as a spoken hub model, is set up as a transaction from a farther distance away, maybe not in the loop, historically,
mm-hmm.
to then your workplace in the loop and back again.
Yeah, Oak Park, the loop. Oak Park, the loop.
Right.
Oak Park, loop. And you had a life that was very distinct.
Separation.
Yeah. So you had actually two parts of a day. So you would arrive. You would work 8 to noon. You would take a lunch break where you would go out of the office into the city and then come back into the workplace. And at 5, catch your train and go, right?
Yeah. And pre-pandemic, often that was how most people existed too. That was still a model
Had it not evolved a bit?
I don't think it had evolved that much.
Really?
I mean, I think if you look at statistics and numbers, though, pre-pandemic, I think according to the Pew Research Center, there were only 77% of individuals that were in some sort of hybrid work format.
Hmm. I would have thought it was more.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Whereas today, I mean, in 2023... 35% of workers who can work from home are actively doing so, which still seems small, but I think you're seeing an evolution now of we were forced to all work remotely for those of us that could, and now we're encouraged as the pendulum swings back to find some harmony,
yeah,
which changes, all that to say, it changes the point A to point B mentality.
Yeah.
But the city, although Chicago, I would say specifically, has still struggled with if point A to point B doesn't exist anymore, if point B is my workplace and that was its function, what is its future?
Right. Absolutely. And how do you make place? So there are discussions about how we evolve that place. How do we evolve the loop? How do we evolve the center of all of our cities, Manhattan, et cetera? And interestingly, I think people are looking really superficially at that problem. I don't think it's just about like putting toys. It's not like a Google response to workplace design. So like if you look at the detailed workplace, the more minute scale that we just looked at for a period of 4-5 podcasts, we were looking at, you know, it's not about creating a interesting ball pit to sit in and play your games. It's about having a blend of amenities at the workplace that help support work, not just fun. Yes, there may be fun there. There might be entertainment that's there. But at first, it seemed like we were just making everything fun. You know, like everything was about like ball pits and ping pong tables and whatever. And I remember doing a project for an insurance company, and it was a discussion like, well, should we put in foosball and or should we put in like, this is so not important to the overall discussion. It's just put something in there to make people feel like they can take a break, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, my point is that when we were looking at the workplace, we recognized that that was not the end all. Mm-hmm. That was an idea to spark a change in the workplace where it was not just about a monolithic explanation of process at that workplace. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't just about going to a workstation and doing administrative work and then leaving. But it actually had the opportunity for you to learn and grow in different environments, like through play, through other types of activities. And I think a lot of it has to do with the blurring that's occurred, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm old enough to have experienced a life that was much like that, right? Like there was a very distinct time cut, and then I was home with my wife and family.
Mm-hmm.
And that is all gone.
Yeah, the right? pandemic completely erased any sort of separation for a lot of us that had the capacity to work from home.
Right. Like, it's just now, like, it's all blurred and it's murky. So how do you differentiate place? And how if it's not purposeful, like, that was purpose-driven, the workplace of the past.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not singular in purpose, how do you make place meaningful?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that has a lot to do with how do you enrich the function of your job? How does the space that you're working help you be better at what you're doing, be a better person, be a better worker, be more efficient, whatever that means? I think the question becomes effectiveness in the tasks that you're given in whatever your defined job is, as well as the opportunity to grow and learn from others. That doesn't happen in isolation. I mean, if we all just woke up one day, we all learn how to breathe inherently. No one tells us how to do that. But that's not necessarily how work happens. That's not how you grow.
Right.
You grow through observation, through osmosis, through active learning and mentorship and sponsorship. That can't exist in isolation. It's just impossible. And the question then is, how do you facilitate a workspace that allows those moments to happen? That aren't forced, that are supportive and additive, and provide a reason, similar to how a ping pong table might have provided a reason for someone to go into the workplace, but it's a much more holistic reason than just something superficial.
I think that there's an issue that can be explored as well in relationship to those people who are choosing to remain and live in an urban setting, and those who are beginning to explore suburban. So historically, I would say as an architect, I'm going to make a declaration that we frowned upon suburban lifestyle, right?
Why do you think that is?
Because I think that we felt it was contributing to sprawl. We felt that it was somewhat less about community. So like, I grew up in a small town in eastern Ohio. And it was a place, and everybody knows your name type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in a city, there's a place as well, and you feel immersed in a community. In a suburb, there is isolation that occurs. And it's not really, well, that's why it's called suburban. It's not really urban, and it's not rural. So it's suburban. And I think there was a myth that it was an enriching sort of experience. But based upon patterns of behavior that were historic in the workplace, where you had a destination in the loop and had to go back out, it reinforced the idea of the suburbs being not intellectual.
Or othered.
Or othered, right? This is horrible, but I didn't really think in my lifetime, oh, I have to move to the suburbs because I want to go to dinner parties with and have, you know, deep intellectual conversations. It was more like, oh, in the suburbs, we're going to go and have cookouts and talk about our children.
Mm-hmm. Right? Well, it's about the American dream. That was the definition of suburban life post-war until today, I would offer. That it's the idea of ownership, of having land, having more real estate than you can have in a city. But then the implications of that are typically your workplace is farther away. There is that transaction of point A to point B. And there is then separation of life. But the pandemic has completely changed that now, where the hub and spoke model still happens, but it's in a much more isolated, maybe nodal fabric. So if I'm in the suburbs, I'm searching potentially for a workspace that's closer to my home than downtown would have been or is. And that's starting to introduce a whole new fabric in a way for companies to struggle with how to develop their real estate portfolios and best support their talent in the ways in which they are choosing to live and the ways in which they're choosing to work.
Yeah, I think it's the commute. Mm-hmm. I don't think people want to spend an hour and a half on the metro getting to Downers Grove or wherever they're going. I think they want to be able to live there and have access to workplaces that are there and perhaps have a reason to go to another destination periodically, but not on in a ritualistic way.
Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, Groundhog's Day over and over again.
I also recall an experience I had. I don't know why this conversation is so memorable to me, but many, many years ago in college, one of my friends was dating a woman and she lived in a suburb of Columbus called Worthington, actually Worthington Hills. And she described how she had never been to downtown Columbus. And how does that occur? It's only 10 miles away. Well, what did your father do? I don't know. I don't know what he did, right? So her world was very bifurcated, where she had this experience of recreation. Her idea of her father and her interaction was all recreational. It was fun playtime. And that was what that place was made for. The whole community was developed around a golf course country club. And everybody that lived in the community was a member of this country club. And they had 4th of July parades. And it was this idea of America, right? But in many ways, it was separating in the sort of seriousness of work and the intellectual pursuits of those people to solve societal problems or provide goods and services that were really important, as opposed to, I'll go way back, to my grandparents' small little town where you were exposed to the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker. but, you know, they were farmers and they would come in and there'd be the banker and they'd go to the general store and there was a butcher and these people all were there and you knew that. So I guess where I'm getting is like there was a quick blending of purposes and places and you could easily get in a small town to these things. You mm-hmm. could ride your bicycle. You could walk to these places. And the same thing is true in Chicago in certain neighborhoods or in Manhattan, right? Like people say, oh, I live on the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side. And within a half mile walk, you can get anything you need in the world, right? So I think that in a post-pandemic environment, as part of this next series of podcasts, I'd like to explore that idea of how the urban is changing and the suburban is changing, and really begin to explore how there may be a new idea of place.
Yeah, I think even to layer another part of that on it too, I think the rural is changing as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's more individuals that are living in less dense areas that aren't even considered suburban, and they're seeking workplaces and workforces. There are companies looking to cement their reputation and develop their cohort of talent in a far more rural circumstance that introduces a whole other set of questions about movement, about point A to point B, and everything in between. But it is about, I mean, if you look at the definitions of placemaking too. It's about the conversation between the user and the person that's facilitating the user's experience. That's placemaking, giving ownership to both of those pieces of the conversation. And I think that's the other sort of factor. Remember my reflection from season one was the agency of the employee. Now we're sort of setting up, as you just introduced, a series of conversations that are totally predicated on the patterns and ways in which the workforce is choosing to live,
yes,
which therefore inform design, location, real estate portfolios, business strategy, talent strategy. It's a whole other series of considerations based purely on where the workforce is choosing to live.
I'm going to bring an analogy to this. In sort of one of my other lives as part of my firm, we explore alternative pathways to educational excellence. And we have designed a space that changes the dynamic. Instead of the teacher creating the construct for the classroom, it's flipped. The teacher is a visiting advisor, and the student is directing the work or the learning methodology. So the students are meeting in groups. They're creating patterns of behavior, and the space is supporting that by allowing them to have agency, as you recommend. So in a broad way, this is sort of symbiotic, where you have this occurring in education, you have it occurring in workplace, and now we're talking, you and I are talking about how it's occurring in the way people are choosing to live. And employers, as they consider their real estate decisions and their decisions on how they want to design places, they can't program the spaces the way they were before.
Well, actually, what that introduces, I had never thought about that. It's sort of like the Montessori style of learning.
Yes, yes.
How does that exist in the workplace? Because I suspect, too, that this next generation, which is a whole other podcast, their role and their interests in work and the definition of what work is dramatically different than my generation, than your generation. That introduces a whole other series of questions of it's not transactional anymore. So yes, there is an intention about purpose, about why I would go somewhere or how I feel fulfilled at work. Now it's about purpose-driven conversations as well. So back to the interviewee that you recently had, they flipped the question on you immediately. That's purpose-driven discussions that all reflect back and all tie back to a sense of place and a sense of belonging.
I think that by talking about this on a completely different scale than we had in season one, I think we're going to learn a lot. So we're going to learn about how places are created, cities are changing, suburban locations are evolving. And there's also a term you brought up earlier today when we were prepping, exurb.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
I mean, an exurb is sort of sitting even at the fringes of suburban. It's neither urban, suburban, or rural. It's sort of sitting in a new area of space that's in between. So I just talked about completely rural. We have our friends that are trying to navigate that. But it's this new, I suppose you could talk about it as the realistic styles of sprawl that are far more disconnected than a suburban and urban fabric that are sort of sitting in coexistence with one another. But my suspicion is that the more we talk about exurban, it enters into a conversation about nodal frameworks,
mm-hmm.
where it is smaller cities and towns that have smaller and more gentle populations and that aren't as focused on density, but they're equally as important in a constructive framework for the development of certainly American cities, but I would say cities globally too.
I know you have been involved with some work in the Research Triangle. And when I think of what you're talking about, I think of that part of North Carolina.
Totally.
So you don't say I'm from, well, I think they might say they're from Raleigh or Chapel Hill, but most people say they're from the Triangle.
Yeah, in that way, it's talking about the definition of sort of metro areas. Chicago has a metro area that's made up of Milwaukee and other cities along sort of South Bend and that way around
Now, come on, you can't claim Milwaukee.
That's still it's still within the metropolitan area of Chicago.
What?
I think so.
I don't think so.
Okay, we should look at a map okay, later.
I don't think Milwaukee would accept that.
But I think my point, though, is maybe not defined within a metropolitan, like, statistical area, but it's defined within the definition of a megacity. And so there's New York is another great example. What constitutes New York City in the eyes of many is very broad. And I think, though, when you look then at something like North Carolina or look at Northwest Arkansas, it's a collection of cities. Together, they create a framework. They cover a large geographical area, but they're all sort of existing within this strange urban, suburban, rural, exurban. They have all of this gradient in a tighter space than something that's as dense as Chicago, as dense as New York, as dense as LA.
Is it more like Europe?
I think maybe, yeah.
What we think of like connecting by Eurail in Europe from France to Germany to Switzerland and Austria and et cetera, right?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. So I think transportation is key to this discussion. But I think what I'm really interested in exploring is the idea of the different scales and how the human what makes humans feel like they can connect in these places. Because if we're talking about how we can convene, one of the things we were discussing is the idea of a destination.
Yeah, and what destination means. I think that the reasons, the carrot on the stick of why you go to a destination is changing. It's different. It's more nuanced. Not singular. You mentioned that earlier. It's not that I'm going to that destination to work. I'm going to that destination to shop. That's why malls were so popular in their era, in their sort of renaissance of time. That's why the hub and spoke model of a city with a central business district that only had singular zoning worked.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work anymore. So there's sort of this multi-interest that a destination has to have to be able to function successfully. And it's not about scale. It's about diversity of function and a diversity of reason.
So the Magnificent Mile is no longer?
I mean, if you look at any data on it right now, no. Retail and lease rates are down dramatically. You can essentially get anything that you see there online. There's no unique experience necessarily anymore. That's actually the only thing that's sort of thriving there are one-off pop-ups of experiences that are creating some sort of difference of destination. So potentially the only thing that, if nothing changes, the Magnificent Mile has going for it is its legacy of, oh, that is what you do when you go to Chicago. Yeah, I've heard of that thing.
Yeah, like Rodeo Drive and...
Exactly.
And Fifth Avenue, and it's sort of a charming historic place that is anchored by the water tower.
Yeah, and I think another example in Chicago would be to look at LaSalle Street, too. Once a banking and sort of titan finance industry for not just the Midwest, but for the country, there's minimal, if any of that, still happening there. And then you have this vacant building stock and you're like, oh no, what do we do?
Yeah.
The singularness of that changed, which means that the destination function changed, which means that there's a whole new set of opportunities to define why go there, what happens there, and how does it continue to evolve?
Yeah, I was pointing out the Board of Trade building to someone yesterday and I had a hard time rectifying what occurred there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not certain if the floor is still the floor. Or if trading is, it's got to be all digital, right?
Yeah, I mean, the way in which trading used to happen where people were throwing, things all over the place and it was very exciting and they had even, crowd and spectator spots. Right. Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore.
Right. I mean, it's more ceremonial in some ways that there are cameras there and they have the ringing of the bell in New York and et cetera. But to your point, I think all of these places are evolving. And I don't know if we'll have a place. I don't know if we'll have a definition, right? Like, I'll relate it to fashion or music. So when I was very young, I had a sister, And I remember, she's older by 7 years, and I distinctly remember she and my mother having discussions every year about the hemline on the skirt or the dress. And it had to be a certain length. And my mom would mend all of her, you know, they would raise them and lower them based upon what they all had to be. And all of the girls would have that same thing. And when I came into high school and college, it seemed like the rules were breaking a little bit, right? And now I can't imagine someone in high school having a discussion about being uniform in any one way. I mean, if you just show up at a high school, you can see the diversity of choice that's occurring and the pluralism that's occurring within fashion and how that individual choice is really seated. You know, I'm really interested in this dichotomy in America between the individual, the sort of rugged individualism, and the collective whole, and the tension that exists between these two ideas. Because I think it's what makes our country tick, is the idea that you have individual choice, but you're choosing to be part of a collective. We are the United States of America, and we are, you know, there are rules in Ohio and there are rules in Illinois. They're different, but not hugely different, but they are different, right? Mm-hmm. There's different economic policy based on taxation systems and incentives that are put in place, et cetera. We choose to be a part of a collective, but we want our individual liberties. And I think that when we talk about design, that's what we are beginning to explore here, right? Like, a lot of the stuff we're discussing is about how the individual liberty of the person who uses the space has been winning. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about that tension. And will we end up having the collective begin to win? There was a really great article in a journal that I can't not remember because I didn't write it down.
We'll put it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. But there was a really great article that talked about how productivity is down by something like 70% now compared to pre-pandemic. The author's premise was CEOs are starting to see this, and the C-suite is going to start cracking down. I rode the train into the Loop today, and compared to just a month ago, I was astonished at the ridership. Four times as many people. So there is a transition that's beginning to occur where the people in positions of leadership are saying, look, we have to be accountable. You know, we need to bring these things to resolution here. And the interest of the whole, there's a tension, right? And I think that's one of the things that's really interesting in this exploration.
Well, I think the tension, too, begins with choice and self-awareness. I think we've never been offered as many choices as we have since the pandemic introduced the non-optionality of having choices of working on your couch, working on the floor, working in the bathroom, working in the tub. Like, you could do whatever.
What? In the tub? Okay.
Oh, I did that a couple of times. Why not? You get a couple of things done. You can proofread in the tub.
I don't know. Electrical issues with water, but okay.
It wasn't plugged in.
Okay.
It was a risk I was willing to take.
But the point is well taken.
Yeah, that you had all these choices, but were all of those functions, was the tub the most effective spot for me to do my work? Probably not. And I had enough self-awareness to be able to understand that, but not everyone does. And I think that that's where choice and self-awareness begins to introduce itself into questions of productivity, begins to introduce itself into questions of a nomadic lifestyle too. So point A to point B may not exist anymore. There may be 8.1, 8.3, 8.6, and before I even get to B, and I've had all these opportunities to work in a cafe, to work over lunch, to work at a bar, pop into the office every once in a while. I mean, I think that in and of itself, choice, recognition of where I can do functional work productively. I'm a highly productive person, though. Not everyone has that ability to be able to make those decisions and determinations, So they're relying on the collective to be able to help inform.
Right. There's a structure within which they work. So you balance your individual choices with the rules of the game, the rules of engagement that occur. And I recently had a discussion with one of my own employees who said, well, hey, you know, you've just released this, you know, our leadership team had released some new workplace rules in terms of, you know, presence in the studio at certain times, et cetera. And like, how can we do this if we're releasing these studies and seminars that suggest that the flex model is better? My response was, no one said that's better. We were just exposing the fact that monolithic does not work and that each organization has to make the decisions on how they want to work, right? So there's a lot of research on the psychology of workplace. And let's say we are a really successful Fortune 100 organization, and we have processes that have created excellence, and we know that they're going to continue to replicate excellence for the next 5 to 10 years. We're going to work in a place where we can guarantee that level of continuity. So the design needs to support continuity, not disruption. Others, maybe creative agencies or organizations that are trying to evolve themselves, they need disruption, right? So as we look on this bigger scale in 2023 here, and we begin to think about place in a different way, what needs disruption? Is it the urban? Is it this, or how will these things be disrupted?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an existential question, which is what's interesting. That's why I'm excited for season two, is what's working, what isn't working, and where do we go from here? Every evolution of each of those scales happened after some societal change, whether it be war, whether it be the advent of the car and technology. Now we're on the cusp of entering into a new era of change that was societal, social, and scale that will completely revolutionize the way in which cities are defined, the way in which we choose to live and we choose to work. And I don't think we have any answers for them, but I think we have lots of musings and interesting alternative realities that may present themselves through these conversations.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in my work, in my professional work, I'm kind of paralleling this experience where through 2021, 2022, a lot of the work was really specific about workplace. Interestingly, we're being approached to have the same kinds of conversations with municipalities. Like, how do we evolve our place? How do we evolve what we are and begin to reinterpret how we come together and convene? And I think it's very much a lot of the same logic applied, which is this balance between choice and parameters and structure.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we as a society grapple with that?
You've been listening to the first episode in our second season of Workplace Crafted. As we set the tone for this season, we've begun to open up the dialogue to evaluate place at rural, suburban, and urban scales. How do these scales evolve in a post-pandemic world? And how do workplaces drive their evolution? These are the types of questions we will be considering this summer, and we invite you back for some robust conversations with very interesting guests. Today's podcast was produced by Ryan Gann and edited by Spencer Hawk, our podcast guru. As always, thanks to Tommy Hecker for our music, and thanks to our WSA clients who allow us to explore these topics through the design work we do. We'll see you all next time on Workplace Crafted.